Welcome, everybody, to News of the Money World. Today, we're going to be covering off, let's just have a look, a little list here. We have bonds, RBNZ, U.S. inflation, Australia, China, Europe, gold, and maybe oil if we have time. So how are you, Rupert? You good?
I'm very good. How are you?
Excellent. Excellent. I'm determined to get through all of these tasks today.
We'll be super quick. Less rambling and more factual, 100% factual, accurate commentary.
Oh, wow. No pressure there. Okay. Yeah. This is why we have other people editing it, just to make sure it is factual. So let's start with the RBNZ, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. Literally 41 minutes ago at the time of recording, they came out, their decision, holding the OCR, the official cash rate, at 5.5%. My view is that we're going to wait till others go first before we lead the pack. And the reasons will be what the reasons will be. But in your view, Rupert, what are the reasons why? I know you've only just read the same thing that I've read.
Yeah.
But do you want to just go over the reasons why the OCR is on hold?
So look, inflation is still high. There's no question on it, right? I think it's now generally accepted. We are in the middle of stagflation. We've got inflation running at kind of somewhere in that 4-5% range at the same time as we are in recession. So ultimate definition of stagflation. The political masters have made it very, very clear that inflation is the number one enemy right now. And actually, to be fair, Adrian Orr has also come out saying that publicly last week in some interviews, some press stuff that he has done. Therefore, that is why it is on hold. Some of the commentary in that release also suggests that maybe they would have been tempted to go higher. It's kind of if there had been no growth on the way through. I mean, sorry, if it wasn't for the stagflation and the fact that we are in the middle of recession. So it's a bit of a nothing release, broadly as expected. I'm kind of still waiting for my deluge of emails from all the bank economists. So this is a completely uninformed view. But looking through the statement, some of those words around getting inflation back to within the targeted band this calendar year, we haven't seen words like that before. I think previously it's all been pushed out to 2025. And so if anything, I actually see this as, again, my uninformed view, but as a relatively dovish kind of announcement, and potentially kind of once we're going to start to see some forecasts for interest rates to start dropping sooner rather than where they were yesterday.
Yeah, and you're referring to that part of what we read where it says, central bank also suggested tight monetary policy could get New Zealand back into its desired inflation zone of 1-3%. This year. So
yeah,
I guess they're feeling confident that they're doing what they need to do in order to get back to the zone that they said they will get back to and that they have to get back to. So they feel like they're doing a good job, basically.
I think so. And like, it's kind of interesting, right? So I'm just looking down at my screens and I can see that. So the markets are pricing this as a nothing. So exchange rate broadly flat, 0.3% change on the day, interest rates broadly flat. And so I think this is what the market was anticipating. And because remember, the market has been ahead of the Reserve Bank all the way through on this, right? So the Reserve Bank had been saying no interest rate drops until 2025 at the earliest, but market pricing had been kind of more interest rates falling kind of Q3, or probably closer to Q4 of 2024. And I think that's why the market hasn't reacted here, because if anything, the slightly dovish nature of the announcement was what the market was expecting. So it will be interesting to see, is this enough to start to see banks start to make a bit of a move on some of those interest rates? Apparently banks have been unwilling to make changes to those fixed rate mortgages because they're concerned that the current market pricing is too aggressive, but that's going to be harder and harder. So hopefully we start to see some movement on those mortgage rates soon as well.
Yeah. Okay. So on the topic of rates or interest rates over in the US, and it's interesting, right? Because you have all these indicators that show you how the central bank is performing, because they're not directly what the central bank is saying. It's the results of what the central bank is doing that you see. And the market expectations is one of them. Over in the US, looking at the 10-year bond yields is a way to, I guess, predict to a certain extent where the market sees interest rates going in the future as well, right? And I'll read this thing that I pulled out of a Bloomberg article just because I think it kind of sums it up really well. They're saying that Treasury 10-year yields rose to the highest level since November last year and came with a striking distance of the 4.5% level that some investors are watching as the threshold that could determine whether rates will revisit 2023 highs. Man, they could write this better, couldn't they? Yeah. Traders' conviction on the 3/4 point rate cuts from the Fed this year is quickly dissipating, and that's probably the guts of it. Start of this year, the market was kind of getting ahead of itself as well, and they were expecting a lot more aggressive rate cuts than what the Fed was actually saying. And so the Fed has kind of been pretty straight in terms of what they've been saying, more or less. But the market was getting away of itself, and now they're kind of pulling back a little bit, aren't they? And they're favoring just 2 reductions now. So what do you think? Do you think this will go the other way, and we see actually rates are going to go higher now?
Oh, look, I struggle to see rates going higher from here. It's going to need to see a lot to do that. But at the end of the day, we talked about it last time. Some of that amazing data that came out of the US, the fact that interest rates are still where they were, despite the fact that growth is higher, unemployment is lower. And so the US, they are kind of, again, the Federal Reserve, they do believe that they have interest rates, they do believe they have inflation under control. But we do still see an economy which is expected to grow 2-3% this year in real terms, which is absolutely huge. And so that kind of raises the very big question of, sure, you might kind of bring back rates a little bit to kind of take the pedal off the gas and take the pedal off the brake. But I think the broader question that's starting to be asked by a lot of people in the market is, what is neutral? And so when we talk about a neutral interest rate, that means the interest rate at which it is neither causing pain, so it's not halting the economy, and at the same time, it's not acting as fuel on the fire and driving the economy forward. 15, 20 years ago, if you'd asked us that question, we would have said somewhere between kind of 4-6%, which is a combination of 2.5% inflation plus some premium, that kind of plus a return that sits on that, whether that's 2%, 1-2% up to you. But over the last kind of 10 years, we've got ourselves used to the very ultra low interest rates and thought, so a lot of people have been going, is that 3%? Is that 3.5%? And I think that's the big question that's really going through people's minds as they're seeing expansion at these higher interest rates. Actually, how much lower are they going to go? What does that mean for the new neutral? And that is why we're starting to see those 10-year yields kind of creep up again. Even at 4.3%, there's a lot of people that could argue that, you know what, a 4.3% 10-year yield, that's actually implying that a through the cycle kind of cash rate, Fed's funds rate, is somewhere in that 3.5-4%, which is materially lower than it was in that period from kind of the early 90s through to kind of mid 2000s.
Is that why markets are kind of still really, really strong? Because when you look at it on the street, like on Main Street, not the Wall Street, but Main Street, it feels quite subdued. I'm back in New Zealand now here thinking like this, and I'm guessing it would be not too dissimilar in the US. But markets have been incredibly resilient with what you were just saying. Is that the reason why? Is because they're kind of anticipating where this new neutral rate is?
I think there's three things that are driving markets to where they are despite these higher interest rates. One is we're kind of now, 18 months into this kind of raising cycle. We haven't seen any damage come through. And so maybe the economy isn't quite as interest rate sensitive as we previously thought it was. I think there's a lot of people testing those historical beliefs and historical assumptions. It's always pretty dangerous when you get to that perspective and kind of into that world. The second thing that's driving a lot of the economy and a lot of that growth at the moment is, the second thing, which is highly related, is actually 3% economic growth. That is an amazing number, right? And 3% economic growth, what that does is that will drive a huge amount of profit. So this year we should see fairly solid operating profit growth at a company level. There will be higher financing costs, but you kind of have that piece there. And then the third big bull case sitting in behind it is this productivity gain, where everyone believes, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, coming out earlier this week, an amazing letter that everyone should read, but coming out talking about the fact that he sees AI having the same potential as the steam engine, and driving huge amount of change and efficiency into companies, into the broader economy, right? And so I think there's just all of these things that are kind of floating around in an investor's mind. There's also a little bit of a, hey, look, you know what? The Fed have been pretty clear about the fact they don't want to see a crash here. And so similar story to the last 20 years, right? Don't fight the Fed. The Fed put is there. And increasingly investors are starting to believe that at the very first sign of weakness, the Fed's going to step in and going to drop their pants and do what they need to do to avert crisis.
Yeah. Okay. So the and the U.S. inflation story, like I always kind of keep on going back to this idea that, and I can't remember where I would have heard this. No, I don't think that's where I would have heard it. Yeah, no, Dr. Richard Werner, he was the grandfather or the godfather of, or he coined the phrase quantitative easing, but his version of quantitative easing isn't what was actually employed. It was when he was advising the Japanese central bank, I believe it was. And his kind of thesis, from what I understand, is that sometimes the Fed or central banks will, it's like the tail is wagging the dog rather than the dog is wagging the tail. And the reason why they're increasing and decreasing interest rates is really to maintain credibility in front of the market, to prove that they do have some degree of control. But really, it's a confidence game in that they really can't control where interest rates go. And in the case of the U.S., you can kind of understand that when you understand that a lot of the euro-dollar system is beyond the control of U.S. regulators. Have you ever encountered that theory? And do you think that there's any weight behind that? That's a wild one that I just threw in there, Rupert. Sorry about that.
I'm just trying to think. Do I think that the central banks have as much control as they think they do? No. Do I think it's down to other forms and other sources? No, I just think that basically, unfortunately, over the last 15, 20 years, or probably the last 30 years, risk management has become such a big structure in absolutely everything that we do. And that means that a whole lot of financial products have basically been built to protect against these events, which is kind of why we're not seeing what we're doing. So I actually do believe the impact of interest rates is lower than it was. I do believe that central banks don't have as much control as they previously did. What I don't get in my mind is that because of a lag factor, or is it just not quite there at all, right? In some respects, you also argue a lag factor. And so, say, for example, if you're running an average maturity on your debt profile of, say, 2 years, 3 years, which is what a lot of the big American corporates, or at least that, which is what the American corporates have been doing.
Yeah.
That gives you a really good chance to kind of build your balance sheet and protect a bit of war profits for when it does get tough as well. So, yeah, it is an interesting one. I think I probably answered a very different question to the one you asked.
No, but, it's okay. That wasn't a scheduled question, so you're allowed to do that. That's okay. But that's weird, though, that this is all happening kind of during a period of time, like the lag, or I guess this charade that they're trying to keep up, is happening during a period of time where increasingly we're looking at what central banks are doing a lot more closely than I remember looking at them in the past. Like in the past, it feels like we had a bit more appropriately weighted. But now it's like, perhaps because of the decade-long Fed put sort of concept, maybe that's why. I don't know.
But we care, right? We care about things that impact our daily lives. And the two things that impact our daily lives, one is inflation and the second is our mortgage rates. And the reason we haven't cared, it's like we haven't cared about anything for the better part of the last 15 years is for two reasons, or is for the main reason that the Fed was kind of irrelevant in that inflation was low, so we didn't care about that. And interest rates were pretty low, so we didn't care about those either. And that's kind of why it was an extremely easy period to be a central banker, because the world did everything for them, right? They didn't actually have to do it.
Yeah, interesting. So you mentioned, I think the term that you used was debt lag. I'm not quite sure if that was the term. Yeah, debt lag. So, and I think about Australia, because we should probably kind of pivot more towards the next topic. So thinking about Australia right now, on the mortgage side, I'm aware that a lot of borrowers are floating over there, or there's a higher degree of floating rate mortgages over there. So they are quite sensitive right away to interest rate changes here in New Zealand. A lot of us borrow, a lot of us fix for 1 or 2 years over in the States. They might fix for a lot longer. And I think they can fix for all the way up to 30 years if they really wanted to. And so you have this defense against the policies of central banks because you're immune from those changes personally at a household level. Whereas in Australia, it's a different story. And so we were saying before we hit record that they in Australia, the central bank, RBA, paused a little bit too early. Things maybe got a little bit away on them. I know the property market in some areas appears to be still very, very hot. Do you think they've kind of lost control? Like, would you expect that they would lower rates fairly soon? After the Fed, presumably, or do you kind of feel like they might have to stay higher?
It's going to be a really interesting one, right? I mean, Australia is actually similar-ish to us, so they're continuing to grow. I mean, it's an economy that is highly exposed to China. Commodity prices are falling, and that should cost them cash, and that should cost them dearly as well, the China slowdown there. But what they have got is they've got this humongous migration boom. And so they've had, I think their population is expected to grow like 3% this year. I think it's even, they've had more migration on a per capita basis than New Zealand has had. And so what that's doing is that's driving a whole lot of the growth. At the same time, Australia have always been better at some of that productivity and all of those kind of things. So it is a really interesting one. And kind of even this year, in the last 12 months, they've still had, despite the higher interest rates and the fact that everyone's on variable rate mortgages, they've still had house price inflation. They've got one of the best housing markets in the world still. They've also got one of the most overpriced housing markets in the world. But yeah, so I think it's going to be a challenging one for Australia because they, on one hand, they still have inflation, not quite as bad as what we've got here in New Zealand, but it is still there. They've also got a central bank that will be kind of a little bit gun shy about after what they did early last year, and so that it is going to be really interesting. I mean, and that's why I think the next 4 or 5 weeks will be fascinating to see the synchronization of all these global kind of reserve banks, right? New Zealand, first to go to Switzerland, go last week or 2 weeks ago, first to kind of come down. Who really cares about Switzerland, though? They're tiny. New Zealand today, again, no one cares. ECB, the big one, they'll be going kind of tomorrow. I think everyone expects a hold there. But at the same time, kind of with a pretty clear signal that the next meeting, they're expecting to start cutting rates. And then kind of the big question will be the US at the end of the month, kind of when they report, what are they kind of saying about their timelines? So I think from Australia, when they report this week, for them, it's all about just hold on. They're kind of still in pretty uncertainty. And we still haven't seen yet the synchronization of the central banks. Are they going to move together or are they not? But I think the one thing we can all be pretty confident in, you don't want to be the last one standing here. And I think you will, once you start to see kind of particularly the US go, I'd be very surprised if the rest didn't start to fall pretty sharply off the back of that as well.
Oh, yeah, totally. Just to clarify, though, what do you mean by you don't want to be the last one standing? Like, you don't want to be the last one to lower your rates?
Well, I think there's a risk that, I mean, if you're sitting there as the only one in the world that hasn't dropped rates yet, you've got to be very confident that you've got a very different economy than everyone else. And I think, to me, I'm not convinced there are that many material differences in the economies, apart from, say, the US, which has shown higher growth than others. But to me, I think if you are the last one standing, that's probably an indication that you've pushed it too far, and that you've been you're probably more on the camp of policy mistake than kind of fixing and getting inflation down.
Yeah. Okay. And it's certainly like with all things media, especially with some of the media reports that have come out in the last week talking about the loss of trust in media. Quite a significant loss of trust. I mean, it's really hard to understand, or it's really hard to take some of the things that we read seriously increasingly. on that topic, China, I saw a full page ad in the New Zealand Herald talking about facts, but it said advertisement on the top right hand corner. So I just wonder how that works. But at least it's obvious here, right? I'm just not sure if it's obvious there. But the Chinese economy appears to be stronger than what we had feared. Yeah. Do you trust that?
Yeah, I think you kind of do, right? I think you kind of do, because it's the surveys, it's the some of the PMI data, the production, manufacturing. A lot of it is starting to kind of come right. And at the end of the day, you have to kind of go back up right up to the top level and bring yourself back to first principles. What's the biggest risk to the Chinese kind of regime and the Chinese Communist Party? It is economic, right? At the end of the day, if the Chinese Communist Party get their legitimacy from the fact that the next generation is far better off and far wealthier than the previous generation, and they expect they might not like everything that happens, but at least they make them wealthier. And I don't think, and as much as we might not like the way they do things, we all kind of have to agree that the Chinese are actually pretty good at getting shit done when they want to. And they're far more competent than any other authoritarian regime that I know of, apart from Singapore, probably.
They're your favorite authoritarian regime, aren't they, Rupert?
The most competent.
Okay, cool. Not most
the most competent. Okay. But that, what I mean is, and so I sit there and I go, fuck, you've got a competent regime. You've got they also know that they have to get this sorted. Otherwise, well, they're fucked. They're out of power. And so you kind of sit there and put those two things together and go, it has to be solved at some point. Is it today or is it not? Some of the data is saying maybe it is happening now. And so, yeah, you kind of have to, maybe you do start believing it. And that's at least my view of why it will happen. Is it today? Is it in 3 months? Is it in 6 months? I'm not sure, but it will happen at some point soon because they have no choice.
Yeah. Well, I hope you're right, because if it's not true, then what do countries do when they get into a spot of bother internally?
Yep.
They go to war, and that's not ideal. We're seeing that probably pick up in every hot spot in the world. US is no different, right? And so that's kind of we want it's like the bread and circus of nation states, isn't it? The economy is, right? It keeps people occupied, keeps people happy. It's not real, but it keeps people happy watching their balances go up. But as soon as they start reflecting on deeper, meaningful things, I think that's where it gets a little bit sketchy.
And that's where you've got to distract them. That's where the distraction technique. Don't look there at your wallet. Look up there at the Ukrainian enemy.
Yeah, that's right. And like one of the interesting things though, that I was reading when I was reading that article around China, I think it was connected to this, was the computer chip industry is expected to grow by around 10% yearly from here on in. And I've heard some of the similar stories coming out of the US as well. And naturally you think, well, chips, what do we use chips for? Consumer electronics, right? But missiles and a lot of war equipment depend on these chips too. And I just wonder how much of this is really about hedging themselves, right? Like they're trying to build in multiple fronts to make sure that, hey, the economy is doing well, the armed forces is doing well. It must be, it's so complicated, like just from an investor's point of view to understand this.
But no question that's what's happening. I mean, that's not even, I don't even think that's even up for debate, is it? I mean, the truth is, you look at what's happening in the chips is I agree 100%, that's the perfect example, right? They are they've spent kind of hundreds of billions of dollars building a domestic chips industry purely so that they can fund their military ambitions or so that they can power the military stuff, right? Well, to be fair, there's also some electronic stuff there, right? Why do you think that the biggest person complaining when Huawei announced their latest phone, which had quite an advanced chip, was the Department of Defense? Because they kind of said, if they can do this for a phone, then of course they can do it for a missile too. So, yeah, it is a really interesting one. I find it kind of interesting where some of this Chinese conversation is going though, right? Because also the latest set of conversations in my mind, it's actually a lot more about protectionism than it is about kind of national security and defense and all that kind of stuff, right? I think we talked about it last time, the fact that you've got Elon Musk coming out going, hey, politicians, you've got to do something about China because they're currently producing cars cheaper than us and better than us. And if you want us to keep going, then you're going to have to kind of stop the Chinese, which is kind of interesting from such a free market thinker. But anyway, that's a different conversation. And now you saw last week with Janet Yellen in China, where she's kind of spent 2 weeks or 10 days basically saying, so you guys have to stop manufacturing so much. You can't be as good as at manufacturing as what you're doing. You got to stop investing in manufacturing and getting so good at it. It's basically the crux of what she's saying, despite the fact that the US have gone and spent, I can't even remember, but how many trillion dollars in a CHIPS Act and an Inflation Reduction Act, which was basically doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. And then, so commodities, right? Oil and gold are the ones that I'm kind of thinking about at the moment. And I think when you see interest rates take off, it's a symptom, and it's a symptom of higher cost, right? Like, and that higher cost is a symptom of lower rates, most likely before that, which pumps up asset prices, gives people more money to spend on a finite, all that sort of story. So when you think about oil, we're at $100 a barrel ish right now. Yeah. That could go higher. It's really interesting because we have, when we think about some of the biggest expenses that happen in our household, we have fuel. Some of us will have fuel and some of us will have mortgage payments. And the mortgage payments get more expensive because of central bank intervention occasionally. And then oil gets more expensive because who knows why? Sometimes it's a little bit confusing and a little bit weird as to why that happens. And it's also weird that rising oil prices are sometimes said to be inflationary, yet rising mortgage rates are somehow deflationary. And it's just really weird, right? Because the best cure for rising prices is rising prices. So I don't know where I'm going with this, to be honest, but I just find it really weird that we're in a high inflationary time and we're kind of being told things that don't really make sense logically. But I even remember this just from economics 101, that this is the way it goes. Do you have a view on the whole oil thing that's happening right now?
Yeah, I do. I'll come back to the inflation. I'll start with the inflation question, right? Because I can't remember the exact number, but something like 5 to 10% of all input costs are related to oil. And so that might mean transport. That might mean kind of raw materials, if you're plastics or anything like that. Or there are so many facets that kind of come back to oil, right? And so that's why when we talk about weaning our economy off oil, then actually it's just way harder than anyone can ever expect or anyone ever thinks. So today we're sitting at oil up to kind of $90 for Brent. They're up from kind of 3 or 4 weeks ago. We were at 60 to 70, well, in the mid 60s. The truth is everyone is petrified about what is happening in the Middle East. We kind of have the whole, so Gaza seems to be blowing up, getting worse and worse by the day. It's becoming increasingly hard for the rest of the Arab world to ignore what's happening there in the humanitarian crisis. We had Israel last week directly striking Iran, admittedly inside Syria, but taking out the Iranian embassy in Syria, which was a kind of as close to a direct attack as you can get. And so I think everyone is petrified, right? Tensions are very, very high. And are we entering into a world where we're starting to get a bit nervous that, you know what, are we reaching that tipping point and we're about to see some kind of real supply issues? And that's what's happening on that side. Plus, you've got a US economy, which is going gangbusters. Plus, you've got a Chinese economy, which is supposedly recovering. Europe starting to potentially come out of recession, just maybe, maybe, maybe. So we've got a supply issue, which everyone's petrified that we're about to have a supply issue. And we've also got a world where we are starting to see some pretty good demand signals as well. So, it's a really tough one, what's happening there. For all of us and for the sake of our mortgages, I hope it turns into nothing, because if oil goes to 120, there is no way goods inflation comes down. Oil at $120 means goods inflation spikes, which unfortunately means that interest rates probably stay higher for longer. Well, I mean, that's what happened in the 70s, right? It turned an oil crisis, drove the inflation, which then kind of becomes self-perpetuating.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the other dynamic here, though, is that we're clearly seeing an axis form in the world here, Gaza, Red Sea, Taiwan, Ukraine. It's bipolar. We've got a potential new currency coming down the pike at some stage. Who knows? Maybe that explains the next topic, which is gold. So central banks gobbling up gold like crazy. And I think it was like 2,300 and something last time I checked yesterday in terms of the gold price per ounce, U.S. dollars. All-time highs. So here's a weird thing, right? So we see gold acting in a weird way. Often when you look at gold, you would say, hey, it's a safe haven asset. Some people say it's an inflation hedge, but this whole safe haven thing is very closely related to a risk asset as well. And I guess it makes sense because somebody's hedge is somebody's speculation, right? But the price of gold seems to be looking ahead somehow, maybe at much, much, much lower interest rates. And maybe that's why it's taking off. Or maybe it's because central banks are gobbling it up willy-nilly. Do you have a view? And I've got some technical views, but more like a fundamental view in terms of why gold is taking off.
My suspicion is it's supply and demand, very similar to what we've seen with Bitcoin over the last kind of 6 to 8 weeks with the ETFs. And we are seeing central banks going absolutely filling their boots with gold. And that's because increasingly the dollar, the weaponization of the dollar, and by that what I mean is all of the sanctions that are being put in place. Again, we had Janet Yellen talking openly about using the US dollar sanctions even more and more and more. And so, again, gold is not a massive asset. There's not a huge amount of gold just sitting around everywhere for people to gobble up when they want to. And so to me, I suspect what is happening right now is purely a supply and demand. The central banks are getting increasingly nervous about holding US dollars, not because they're scared about a default, but more they're scared about what actually happens, about the sanctions and kind of what happens if they fall afoul of the US government. And that would be my primary view, right? I'm not 100% convinced on the inflation hedge and how many people kind of think it's that much. To me, it's supply and demand.
Okay. So you mentioned maybe they're doing it because they're scared of sanctions. They've seen what happened when the US kicked Russia out of the SWIFT system. They don't want to be kind of manipulated in any way at that financial layer. So they're holding gold as their reserves instead of US dollar securities. So how much of it, though, do you think it could be relating to getting ready for a new currency, like a BRICS currency, which is backed by other currencies and gold?
I just think administratively that would never work. And there's quite a good article I read, I think it was in The Economist or somewhere last week. The truth is the BRICS economies are all clubby and they do a whole lot of stuff together and they talk about unwavering support for each other. Yet they're all just sitting there taking advantage of each other, right? You got India and China who are busily buying oil out of Russia. They're not doing it because they love Russia. They're doing it because they're buying it for $10 a barrel cheaper than they get it for anywhere else in the world. Have we seen these economies step right into the fray to truly help? No. So I don't know. I personally believe that these are all marriages of convenience. They're getting a whole lot out of each other. There'll be some technology sharing and all of that kind of stuff that they will be doing to enable growth and kind of trying to pick up the slack from where some of the US stuff is dying off. Yeah. But are they about to jump into bed and do stuff materially different? I doubt it. I think if anything, if we're going to see a second currency, the only one that I can see working is the Chinese one. But again, that's not going to happen until we get rid of a whole lot of the restrictions that the Chinese government places on it. So it's a really tough one. We were talking about the euro being that alternative currency, but we've given up on that idea. These currencies, they don't work when you've got these other central issuing places. I think there are a lot of technologies that will enable the payment systems and making all of that stuff a whole lot easier. But actually, mm-hmm. when you kind of think about what you need to be a reserve currency, you need to have risk-free bonds. You need to have all of these other instruments that accompany it. And that's what the ECB and the Euro have found. They can't deliver of all of the other things that you get, which requires to be a risk-free currency, which is why everyone kind of still uses the US dollar. My view would be nothing much changes.
Yeah, no, I get it. And I understand your rationale before. I understand the whole BRICS piece, and I've heard a lot of really smart people speculate that that's the way it's going to go. I kind of also think the opposite, that if anything, we'll probably get a new currency, which is like a one world currency, because that's where you get rid of all that sort of stuff. And if you're trying to force peace on the world, that's probably the only way you're going to do it, is to force people to use one currency, which doesn't come from a pre-existing country.
It's a one world government, right? Even if it's a block, that's still kind of a country, right? And so, that is the ultimate argument for, I guess, coming back to our crypto world, right? Where we sit there and we say, if we can get the volatility, and this is actually one of the reasons why, I know it's kind of a little bit perverse, but if you could get rid of the volatility out of the valuation out of Bitcoin or some of those other things, then all of a sudden, all of this stuff becomes a whole lot easier, right? If we are going to have a new global currency, to me, it can't be issued by a state. But then how long do the states let it continue? Because controlling currency is a great way to control people and everything else.
Oh, man. I'm going to get to work immediately on a new conspiracy theory around Bitcoin then. That's good. Okay. Man, we've covered a lot. And maybe I'll do a post on the Trump Truth social media. That's probably a discussion for next week, though.
I don't even think it's much. I just find it highly amusing. And I feel very sorry for a whole lot of these retail investors that went into this thing. All of a sudden, Donald Trump was I think he was worth many, many, many more billions than he had before.
Yeah.
And it's all coming crashing down. Is it a sign that the rest of the Trump world is coming crashing down? Who knows? But that is a really, really tough one that I think is going to be pretty interesting to see kind of where it all lands. In New Zealand, we've got AIB, someone posted today, this little random company with three tiny little speculative pieces is worth over $200 million, more than Synlait Milk, which again might be worth zero next week. Who knows? But there's just some random shit happening at the moment. And I thought the Trump media one, which I thought was another really nice one, which shows invest in things that are real, diversify, follow the normal rules, because stuff does eventually come crashing back down again.
Yeah, it's always weird around the edges, but in the middle, stick in the middle of your lane. Yeah. Cool, man. All right. Thank you for that one. Let's catch up next week.
Bye. Yeah.